This will be a brief financial history of the United States. This is an audio tape presentation which I had put together several years ago. Since that time, I have a better knowledge of the Great Conspiracy and the descendants of Cain and Esau who are behind it. At the time I originally made this tape, I understood the Esau-Edomite connection, but lacked the full knowledge of the Cain connection. You will hear me many times making the remark, quote, Edomite Jews, unquote. To be more correct, I should have said the Cain satanic Edomite Jews. With that said, let's proceed with that presentation. One more thing. This will be only the financial history with all the other things I said at that time edited out.
When the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock to found the first New England colony, several other colonies had already been created in America. In 1565, the Spaniards had settled in St. Augustine, Florida. The French established a colony at Port Royal in Nova Scotia in 1605. In 1607, the London Company established a colony at Jamestown, Virginia. In 1614, the Dutch settled in Manhattan Island, calling it New Amsterdam, now known as New York. The arrival of the Mayflower at Plymouth, Massachusetts, on December 21, 1620, was the first mighty vanguard of a great multitude to arrive from across the sea. English immigration on a large scale followed and resulted in the establishment of the colonies of Maine, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire. Very little, if any, money during those years of colonization was seen in America. The settlers bartered their produce and goods with each other. But after the first hardy pioneers built their homes and cleared the forests for their fields, men of considerable means in way of money joined the steady procession from the Old World. They brought gold and silver coin, and this was used to facilitate trade between the people comprising the various colonies, and also the trade between the colonies themselves. Indian wampum, black and white shells which represented money among the Indians, also found its way into the hands of the whites, who quickly learned that they could use it as a medium of exchange very satisfactorily. Later, wampum actually became legal tender in some of the colonies. The colonies also began to stamp gold and silver coins of their own and put them into circulation. Now, when the colonies were chartered by the British government, they were set up as sovereign states. As sovereign states, each state was given the right to originate and control its own money, which they did. The reason why the colonies were granted and allowed to exercise this sovereign power is because the colonies were founded when the British government itself exercised the sovereign power over money. Later, the British government would give this sovereign power to coin and regulate money over to the House of Rothschild, who were Edomite Jews. When the charters were given to each of the colonies by the British government, this power of coining and regulating money was included in these charters. But the British government, like the United States government today, allows private individuals to coin and regulate money. How and when did this come about? In 1694, William of Orange, King of England, needed money to raise an army for the purpose of keeping the Stuarts from regaining the crown. He went to the rich merchants in London to acquire this money. They agreed to lend it to him, provided he would give them the right of issuing banknotes against the indebtedness. This is the origin of the Bank of England. This privately owned bank began to manufacture money and substitute privately created money for the money formerly originated by the British government. In other words, the British government forfeited its exclusive sovereign right to create money. Before long in the colonies, however, it became apparent that trade was being hindered because of insufficient money or something to use for money. Thus it came about that a circulating or exchange medium called colonial scrip was printed by the governments of the various colonies. By that creation of adequate purchasing power, great prosperity came to the colonies, inasmuch as there was an abundance of produce and goods available. The nations of the Old World from which the colonists had come were in constant war with each other. As a consequence, those nations' colonies frequently came into wars with each other. The Indians were induced to become involved in those wars. The colonists from England, supported by soldiers from England, finally succeeded in vanquishing their foes. By the Treaty of Paris in 1763, England gained possession of all the land east of the Mississippi River from Hudson Bay to the Gulf of Mexico, and the important thing here, the scrip of the English colonists became the money of all those new lands, and that set the stage for a monetary invasion by the Edomite Jew House of Rothschild. Shortly after the treaty in Paris, Benjamin Franklin was visiting England. While there, he was asked to explain the reason for the prosperous conditions of the colonies. His reply was, quote, "That is simple. It is only because in the colonies we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip, and we issue it in the proper proportion to the demands for trade and industry," unquote. Benjamin Franklin knew that all human institutions had to be managed properly. Well, Benjamin Franklin's explanation was promptly reported to the Edomite Jew House of Rothschild, and the head of that house quickly saw that here was a people ready to be exploited. Here was a people that had been setting up an example and proving that they could issue their own money in place of the monies coming through the banks. Rothschild immediately caused a bill to be introduced in English Parliament, which provided that no colony of England could issue its own money. From that time on, they had to use English money. Consequently, the colonies were compelled to discard their scrip and thus mortgage themselves to the Bank of England, by then already controlled by the Edomite Jew House of Rothschild, in order to get money. Up until that time, the colonies had been thriving, but all that was to change. It was then that, for the first time in the history of the American people, our money began to be based on debt and interest. Benjamin Franklin, in his writings, reported that within 1 year from that date, the streets of the colonies were filled with unemployed people, because when England, through the Rothschilds, exchanged money for the colonists' goods, she gave them only half as many units in payment in borrowed money from the Rothschild Bank as they had scrip. In other words, their circulating medium was reduced 50%, and everyone became unemployed. Franklin went further than that. He said that that was the original and real cause of the Revolutionary War. He stated, quote, "The colonies would have willingly have borne the tax on tea and other imports had it not been that England, by the order of the Rothschilds, took away from the colonies their money, which created the unemployment and led to the war," unquote. You can see from this that what is written in our present-day books and the truth are two different things. In the enactment of that law by the English Parliament in 1764, we have a perfect illustration of the truthfulness of the Rothschild boast. Quote, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who writes its laws," unquote. It is also a perfect illustration of how and why our Federal Reserve Act was foisted upon us by the descendants of that first Edomite Jew, the head of the House of Rothschild, Amziel Moses Rothschild, or Bauer, which was his original name. Well, the peoples of the colonies decided they were going to have none of this, so on April the 19th, 1775, the first armed clashes of the revolution against Rothschild bankerism took place at Lexington and Concord. On May 10 of that same year, the Continental Congress assembled at Philadelphia. George Washington was placed at the head of all our armed forces and took command at Cambridge. On July 4th of the next year, Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence. For 7 years, that war, caused by the Edomite Jew Rothschild power of money, continued. Finally, however, Cornwallis and his army, including what were left of the 16,000 Hessian soldiers supplied by the Edomite Jew Rothschilds to keep America enslaved, was captured at Yorktown on October the 19th, 1781. On September the 3rd, 1783, by the Peace of Paris, the independence of the United States was recognized, and the Edomite Jew Rothschild money control of America was smashed. That is until 1913, when they regained that control by foisting the illegal Federal Reserve Act upon us. Now, before going on with the history of the monetary crimes against the peoples of the United States, let's consider the currency used during the Revolutionary War, and the question is, what kind of money was used during the period of the Confederacy? That is from the Declaration of Independence in 1776 until the adoption of the Constitution in 1789. The answer is, the Continental Congress, comprised of delegates from each of the colonies, originated and paid into use money known as continental currency. Does the commonly quoted, quote, "not worth a continental," unquote, refer to this money? Answer, yes. This phrase is used to describe anything that is utterly worthless. Well then, why and how was the continental money deliberately made worthless? The answer is, it was destroyed by the deliberate counterfeiting, both by individuals and international bankers in London, namely the House of Rothschild. The evidence is ample. Quote, "Counterfeiting, however, was not confined solely to individuals. The British government also embarked in the business. General Howe abetted and patronized those who were engaged in making and pushing these spurious issues into circulation. A shipload of counterfeit continental money," says Phillips, "coming from Britain, was captured by an American privateer. Persons accompanying an English flag of truce are known to have largely made use of the opportunity for dissemination of fraudulent notes. Emissaries from New York endeavored to obtain from the mills papers similar to that used by Congress of its emissions. Many in Great Britain and elsewhere believe that if continental paper money could be destroyed, the Americans would be obliged to submit. This is why the British government promoted so extensively the business of counterfeiting," unquote. Now, quoting General Clinton's letter to His Majesty, the King of England, General Clinton was a British general. Quote, "No experiment neglected," and so forth, "no assistance that could be drawn from the power of gold or the art of counterfeiting have been left unattempted. But still the currency, like the widow's cruse of oil, has not failed the Congress. I shall, nevertheless, my lord, continue assiduous in the application of those means entrusted in my care. If they cannot work its destruction, yet they can embarrass the government and make carrying on the war more precarious, burdensome, and less energetic, unquote. Financial History of the United States by Bowles. Do those who cite the failure of the continental currency tell why it became worthless? No, they never refer to the deliberate counterfeiting or to the fact that those counterfeiters increased the volume of continental currency many, many times the amount properly paid into by the Continental Congress. It was the malicious counterfeiters and the international bankers who, having control of the Bank of England, destroyed the value of the continental money. The Articles of the Confederation, quickly drawn, had not given the Continental Congress power to punish the counterfeiters. Well, I guess you can understand why the continental currency failed, with shiploads of it being sent in from England, complements of the international banking house of Rothschild, that is, shiploads of counterfeit continental currency. However, let's continue with what followed in the history of United States money. In 1786, 55 delegates from the majority of the colonies, now each a sovereign state, met to formulate a plan whereby the states would be enabled to live amicably with each other and to outline a policy to facilitate trade and industry. The delegates labored for 4 months over the problems presented, the principal one being as to how the northern states with paid labor could compete with the southern states' free slave labor. It appeared doubtful for a time that an agreement could be arrived at and a unified nation established. Both sides made compromises. The Constitution minus the Bill of Rights was the result. A constitutional convention was called for the next year, 1787, at Philadelphia. At that convention, the Constitution of the United States, which embodied provisions for amendments, was adopted by a majority of the states with few alterations. But not forgetting for one moment the bitter experiences through which the people had passed because of that Rothschild forced act of the English Parliament by which the colonies were denied the privilege of creating their own currency and therefore their purchasing power and were forced to accept banker-created, interest-bearing, so-called Bank of England money, the Founding Fathers made sure that provisions were made by the Constitution for an honest and debt-free system. Thus, in spite of strenuous opposition of banker-minded delegates, undoubtedly infiltrated to the convention, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5 was drafted and adopted with the rest of the Constitution, and it is still an important and lawful, though disregarded, article of the Constitution. That article states in part, quote, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, unquote. It is evident that by this provision, Congress alone should be the money-creating agency of the nation. That the term, quote, coin money, unquote, included the printing of currency was later clearly established by at least 8 decisions of the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, although the Constitution is regarded by the citizens of the United States as being a sacred document, and all laws are supposedly made to conform to its provisions, yet because of the entrenched power and intrigue of the Edomite Jew international bankers, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5 has been violated almost continuously since the adoption of the Constitution. The Edomite Jew international bankers are the money creators of the nation. To this concrete fact can be traced the cause of every depression, practically every bank failure, our terrible and utterly unnecessary national debt of $1.4 trillion and the poverty of the vast majority of our people, while vast amounts of the produce of our nation are being deliberately and intentionally destroyed. Wars are the direct instruments of the internationalist conspirators, and always have been. While during the Revolutionary War, our patriots were heroically fighting to break the power of the international bankers and gain national as well as economic independence, a supposed patriot, Alexander Hamilton, who has come down to us in history as a pseudo-founding father, was busily at work in a double-cross job. A hireling of the Bank of England and of the Rothschilds, he proposed in 1780 the establishment of a federal bank owned by private interests, internationalists, with a capital of $12 million, a stupendous amount in those days, $10 million of that amount to be subscribed by wealthy people in America. Now, what about this Alexander Hamilton? Well, along about the 1770s or 1780s, there was a young man who came into this country by the name of Alexander Hamilton. Now, his original name was not Hamilton. His mother's and father's name was Levine. But they were divorced in those days for specific reasons, and she remarried a man named Hamilton, and Alexander took his stepfather's name. Alexander Hamilton came to this country a very bright young man, and he was probably the first intelligent designated outpost of the Edomite Jew Rothschild dynasty, and he did very well. Now, if you are familiar with Jewish names, then you understand that Alexander Hamilton's father was a Jew, which would account for many of the things that Hamilton did. His mother was a French Huguenot, and her married name was Rachel Fawcett Levine, and his father was a Danish Jew. Young Hamilton was furnished plenty of money to come to the United States when he was 15 years old and was educated in New Jersey in a grammar school and entered King's College, now Columbia University, as a special student. Later he studied law. Now, Hamilton entered this country at a time when Jews were not allowed citizenship here. It is recorded that the United States accorded full citizenship to Jews in 1783, the first nation in the modern world to do so. When then and through what act was the sovereign power of the United States first encroached upon? It was in 1791 through the efforts of the Edomite Jew Alexander Hamilton, a privately owned central bank misnamed the Bank of the United States was created. This was a direct violation of the new Constitution, which violation was accomplished only after the death of Benjamin Franklin, who had fought Hamilton's previous proposals and had always successfully prevented fulfillment. What was Alexander Hamilton's position at this time? He was the first Secretary of Treasury of the United States of America. Did this first privately owned bank usurp the power to create and regulate the value of money? Yes. Through its several branches, it coined and regulated the value of money in the United States. Moreover, it enjoyed the power to lend this created money and to tax the citizens for using it. Was this power given to the first Bank of the United States approved by George Washington? No. And Washington was not alone in fighting this power. Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Randolph, together with a galaxy of men whose intelligence framed the Constitution of the United States, were also opposed to Alexander Hamilton. Now, the first Bank of the United States was not the first bank that the Edomite Jew Alexander Hamilton tried to start. Even during the Confederacy period, before our government was established as we know it now, Alexander Hamilton, with the assistance of Robert Morris, actually used public money to nurse into life the Bank of North America. This was a privately owned bank. Fortunately, the Bank of North America was never recognized by most of the states. Thus, in 1783, this Bank of America, not to be confused with the Bank of America today, was organized by Alexander Hamilton and Robert Morris, frontman of the international banking racketeers behind the scenes. As superintendent of finance for the Continental Congress, Morris looted the U.S. Treasury of its last dollar remaining after the 7 years of war, approximately $250,000, and put it in the bank's capital stock. Then the secret leaked out that that supposedly American bank was, to all intents and purposes, a branch of the Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, and that that bank's policy of perpetrating the racket of issuing, quote, receipts, unquote, or, quote, promises, unquote, to deliver gold for about 10 times the amount they really had in gold or real money, and, of course, charging interest on their, quote, promises, unquote, to deliver receipts to be known as banknotes, was to be the policy of the newly established Bank of America, a policy right in line with the Federal Reserve System of today. That discovered knowledge of that planned operation precipitated long and bitter controversy. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, and later Andrew Jackson led the assault against the avaricious foe. Those men knew that were the monopolistic control of the nation's money to pass once again into the hands of the Edomite Jew Rothschild-controlled Bank of England, the gaining of the national independence would have been accomplished in vain, because that which the money powers of England had lost through the Revolution would ultimately be returned to them through the process of mortgages and foreclosures. A charter was refused that proposed bank. In 1791, death removed the mightiest defender of the people's rights, Benjamin Franklin, and the absolutely logical protests of the other statesmen were swept aside by the surge of bankers' gold. In that same year, 1791, Congress granted the exclusive privilege of creating currency based on public and private debt to Alexander Hamilton, who had by that time railroaded his way into the office of Treasury, and to his money-manipulating cohorts by chartering their bank. Thus, in 1791, the Bank of the United States, with its 90 branches, all privately owned, became a reality. With the establishment of the bank and the granting of its charter, Hamilton resigned from the office of Secretary of the Treasury to devote all his time to the exploitation and looting of the then young nation. Thus, in 1791, the stage was set for the international bankers to retake America through the simple process of extending and then contracting credit, by first providing ample money and then by creating a money stringency, by loaning money on mortgages and then foreclosing the mortgagors out of their possessions, and by gathering interest on every dollar in circulation in the nation. What, then, are some of the monetary crimes committed by Alexander Hamilton and his backers against the people of the United States? As was said before concerning the period during the Confederation, while the Revolutionary War was going on, there was counterfeiting on a grand scale, actually shiploads of continental counterfeit money being shipped from England. Well, after the Revolutionary War, these continentals dropped in value to the point that 5,000 continentals could be purchased for one silver dollar as a result of all of this counterfeiting causing inflation. Right after the end of the Revolutionary War, the first monetary crime was committed against the peoples of the then new country. During the war, the Continental Congress had issued about $2 million worth of Continentals. Also, the states had issued about this same amount of fiat dollars. So at the end of the war, there was about $400 million of this currency in existence, and most of it had dropped to almost nothing. Now, the Continental circulated at par for a couple years, then they dropped to 2-to-1, and then 5-to-1, and 10-to-1, and by 1781, they had dropped to 40-to-1, and shortly after that time, they ceased to circulate at all. After that, they continued to drop lower and lower until one could purchase 5,000 Continentals for one silver dollar. Now, that's when the speculators went out and bought them up, so that most all of these Continentals fell into the hands of speculators. Now, when the Constitution was adopted, Alexander Hamilton, representing the interest of the bankers, wanted this entire debt to be absorbed by the general government, not only the federal debt of these Continentals, but the debt of the states with their fiat dollars. This produced a very bitter battle that it almost split the new government before it hardly had started. Finally, though, they had finally agreed upon a compromise. They agreed that they would monetize the debt at the value of the currency when it was issued, which amounted to $72 million. So that set the national debt at $72 million. Now, the speculators that had bought up the Continentals had only invested $6 million buying them up, as low as one silver dollar for 5,000 of them. So as a result, they made a profit of $66 million, and they were paid off in gold. Now, that was one of the first great monetary crimes committed against the peoples of the United States, and this was to start a precedent of obtaining money illegally and dishonestly by a money aristocracy in this country. Well, then, after the Continentals no longer were circulated after 1781, the Congress decided to issue bills of credit carrying interest at 6%. The people accepted these bills of credit and used them for money, but fairly soon these too began dropping in value. After the establishment of the Constitution, the Congress met and they decided to redeem all of these bills of credit at par. Now, the very minute that was decided, Alexander Hamilton sent out couriers at full speed all over the then known United States, and they bought up all these bills of credit for as little as 10 cents on a dollar, and in turn they collected 100% on them in gold. So this was the second great monetary crime against the peoples of the then United States. So there were fortunes made from these dishonest dealings of these speculators. Now, the charter of the Bank of the United States was for 20 years, expiring in 1811. When its officers applied for a renewal of the charter, Congress, realizing the frightful mistake of granting a private institution such tremendous powers, refused to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States, which was actually owned by the House of Rothschild and its co-money racketeers, the English Parliament, always subservient to the Bank of England and the Edomite Jew Rothschilds, found a cause to launch the War of 1812. By this war, they fully expected that the United States would become impoverished and would be forced to come on bended knees to the Bank of England for funds. The condition upon which such funds would be supplied would be the renewal of the charter of what was, to all intents and purposes, a Rothschild subsidiary bank, the Bank of the United States. Tragically, their scheme worked. A subservient and bribed Congress granted a renewal of the charter in 1816, and the Rothschilds gradually acquired a firm grip on our money system through our own greedy bankers. By 1857, that grip became so powerful and the greed so insatiable that they began to plot the actual complete possession of our nation. And they seized upon the natural and seemingly irreconcilable differences and difficulties between the northern industrialists and the southern plantation owners to be their tool to split the nation, which they accomplished with the Civil War. We will now return to the killing by Congress of the renewal bill for renewing the charter of the First Bank of the United States. This bank had a paid-in capital of $10 million in gold and silver money, and when the bank's charter expired in 1811, the bank had to be liquidated, and this capital was all returned in cash with interest or profit of something like 8%. This was a great amount of cash to be put back into private hands at one time for that day and time, and one would naturally suppose that the money lenders would be eager and willing to lend it right out again to anyone with security who might want it. But such was not the case. These money changers or usurers had been deprived of a most valuable concession and privilege, that of loaning and issuing money which was making them millions of dollars, and they were not going to submit meekly to any such treatment. So having been able in 20 years operation of their bank through interest compounded and power to issue money themselves, also to gather to themselves nearly all the actual gold and silver in the States at the time, they proceeded to hoard it and hold it out of circulation. Records of the conditions at that time clearly show that the most of them began hoarding their gold and silver money as it came in, and that they refused to loan it or let it get into circulation in any way. And soon this produced a big panic, a time of tight money and hard times, and business and trade was in a stagnant condition. This hoarding by the former owners of the closed Bank of the United States and other money lenders not only stagnated business all over the nation, but had taken so much real money out of circulation that the state banks, which were comparatively small at the time, were unable to stand the strain of withdrawals, always brought about by fear which the money lenders are so careful to spread abroad at such times. Consequently, this produced untold suffering to the masses. Considering that much of the Bank of the United States was owned by the Edomite Jew English money changers, and remembering their habit of revenge and discipline on those who injure or thwart their plans, you can see why they brought on the War of 1812 between England and the United States the year following the revoking of their bank charter in order to discipline the upstart republic for so refusing to let them operate. Did a second privately owned bank regain the right to coin and regulate the value of money? Yes. After the War of 1812, a charter was given to the Second Bank of the United States in the year 1816 to carry on as did the First Bank of the United States. Through connivance against the government, the treasury notes, when circulated as money, were funded into bonds owned by the bank. Against these bonds, this private bank issued private bank notes, thus enabling the owners of the Second Bank of the United States to draw interest on its money in circulation. Did any American statesman oppose the activities of the Second Bank of the United States? Yes. Andrew Jackson was elected to the presidency on the issue that he would not renew the charter. Thus, the charter of the Second Bank of the United States expired on March 4, 1836. Andrew Jackson said, if Congress has the right under the Constitution to issue paper money, it was given to them to be used by themselves, not to be delegated to individuals or to corporations. The money changers had been able to reach enough congressmen to get this bill passed, but unable to touch President Jackson. The Congress was not able to, however, to get this bill passed over the president's veto, so that left the bank's charter expire in 1836. So again, the Edomite Jew money changers' control of our money system was cut off. Again, the Rothschild bankers decided on revenge, but this time it was to be a war to divide the nation in half, as two smaller nations are easier to control than one big one. The plans were announced at a big Rothschild wedding of Leonora, daughter of Lionel Rothschild, to her cousin Alfonso Rothschild of Paris. On that occasion, Disraeli, a Jew, made an amazingly brazen statement as follows, quote, "Under this roof are all the heads of the family of Rothschild, a name famous in every capital in Europe and every part of the globe. If you like, we shall divide the United States into two parts, one for you, James, and one for you, Lionel. Napoleon III will do exactly everything that I shall advise him, and to Bismarck will I suggest such an intoxicating program as to make him an abject Rothschild slave," unquote. Right then and there was laid the plot to repossess, divide, exploit, and plunder the United States. And subsequent events clearly prove that that plot was put into effect as planned. Judith P. Benjamin, another Rothschild kinsman, was appointed to be the professional agitator and campaign strategist in the southern states, later the Confederate states, and he became the mentor and right-hand man of Jefferson Davis. The Civil War, which came very near to splitting the Union, was the result. Now let's go back to the evil deeds that followed that gathering of the Rothschilds in London for the wedding of Leonora and Alfonso in 1857. As Disraeli had promised, Napoleon III was persuaded that he could greatly increase the power and wealth of France by extending his empire to Mexico and then into Texas, Louisiana, and other border states. We are all familiar with that Maximilian era in Mexico during the Civil War. He, Disraeli, also assured the English Parliament that as a result of the Civil War, the northern states could be transformed into an English colony once again. Throughout the Civil War, Rothschild money, through Judith Benjamin, flowed into the South, and a loan of more than 200 million francs was granted by them to Napoleon for his Mexican campaign. In 1863, the Confederacy was in desperate straits and requested assistance to distract the northern victorious armies. Napoleon was offered Texas and Louisiana in exchange for French intervention against the northern states. When the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, learned of this, he warned France and England that should they extend military aid to the South, he would regard it as a declaration of war against Russia. He gave force to his warnings. He dispatched warships to New York and San Francisco and placed them at Lincoln's disposal. Now let's go back to the evil deeds that followed that gathering of the Rothschilds in London for the wedding of Leonora and Alfonso in 1857. As Disraeli had promised, Napoleon III was persuaded that he could greatly increase the power and wealth of France by extending his empire to Mexico and then into Texas, Louisiana, and other border states. We are all familiar with that Maximilian era in Mexico during the Civil War. He, Disraeli, also assured the English Parliament that as a result of the Civil War, the northern states could be transformed into an English colony once again. Throughout the Civil War, Rothschild money through Judith Benjamin flowed into the South, and a loan of more than 200 million francs was granted by them to Napoleon for his Mexican campaign. In 1863, the Confederacy was in desperate straits and requested assistance to distract the Northern victorious armies. Napoleon was offered Texas and Louisiana, Now let's go back to the evil deeds that followed that gathering of the Rothschilds in London for the wedding of Leonora and Alfonso in 1857. As Disraeli had promised, Napoleon III was persuaded that he could greatly increase the power and wealth of France by extending his empire to Mexico and then into Texas, Louisiana, and other border states. We are all familiar with that Maximilian era in Mexico during the Civil War. He, Disraeli, also assured the English Parliament that as a result of the Civil War, the northern states could be transformed into an English colony once again. Throughout the Civil War, Rothschild money through Judith Benjamin flowed into the South, and a loan of more than 200 million francs was granted by them to Napoleon for his Mexican campaign. In 1863, the Confederacy was in desperate straits and requested assistance to distract the Northern victorious armies. Napoleon was offered Texas and Louisiana in exchange for French intervention against the Northern states. When the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, learned of this, he warned France and England that should they extend military aid to the South, he would regard it as a declaration of war against Russia. He gave force to his warnings. He dispatched warships to New York and San Francisco and placed them at Lincoln's disposal. That threw a monkey wrench into the Rothschild plot to throw France and Mexico into the war against the North. But right at that time, the North was finding great difficulty in financing the war. The interest rate set by the bankers, who as we know were by then controlled by the Rothschilds, was approximately 30%. At the outbreak of the Civil War, it was expected that it would last only a few months, and that probably would have been the case if the European nations, at the behest of the Rothschilds, had not come to the assistance of the South. To solve the financial problem of the North, Lincoln made his wisest move. He turned to the Constitution of the United States, where he quickly found the solution. Appleton's Cyclopedia, 1861, page 296 says, quote, "The money kings wanted 24% to 36% interest for loans to our government to conduct the Civil War," unquote. President Lincoln and his secretary are said to have heedily refused and stated the terms were outrageous, scandalous, unpatriotic, and so forth. And the moneylenders are said to have replied that, quote, "If the government didn't want the money at that figure, why, they could loan it to the Southern Confederacy," unquote. And that is probably what they did. President Lincoln and his secretary were, of course, greatly disturbed and in a quandary as what to do and how to get the money to prosecute the war and pay their soldiers. During Lincoln's worry over this matter, he recalled that he had a friend by the name of Colonel Dick Taylor in Chicago, in whom he had great confidence, so he sent for him and put the problem of finance up to him to solve. Quote, "Why, Lincoln," unquote, Taylor is said to have replied, quote, "That is easy. Just get Congress to pass a bill authorizing the printing of full legal tender treasury notes or greenbacks and pay your soldiers with them and go ahead and win your war with them also," unquote. Quote, Do you suppose the people will take them, unquote? Lincoln is said to have asked. And to this, Taylor replied, quote, the people or anyone else will not have any choice in the matter. If you make them full legal tender, they will have the full sanction of the government, and they will be just as good as any money, as Congress is given the express right by the Constitution, and the stamp of full legal tender by the government is the thing that makes the money good any time, and this will always be as good as any other money inside the borders of our country, unquote. As was to be expected, the bankers and their then-as-today stooges in Congress fought Lincoln bitterly and viciously when he declared his intention to issue paper money according to the provisions of the Constitution. They screamed against the idea of creating money which did not pay them interest. But Lincoln stood fast. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5 provided him with the necessary authority to disregard the bankers despite all their political power. He refused to accept that the Constitution meant, quote, bankers, unquote, where it stated, quote, Congress shall have the power to coin money, unquote. So he rejected all the arguments of the bankers and their stooges in Congress and ordered the Federal Bureau of Printing and Engraving to print and issue $450 million of honest money constitutionally created on the credit of the nation. No need to tell you, the infuriated bankers got very busy. They got their stooges in Congress to pass a bill which ruled that the Lincoln greenbacks, as the United States banknotes were derisively called, would not be accepted in payment of interest on government bonds, nor for import duties. In that way, they caused the greenbacks to become almost worthless, because they, the bankers, could refuse them except at ruinous discount. By this, they beat the value of the greenbacks down to about 30 cents on the dollar, and then, get the fiendish irony of it, bought them and used them at face value to buy government bonds at par, which netted them a neat profit of 70 cents on the dollar. Yes, the bankers didn't get their 30% interest, but nevertheless they were able to draw blood anyway. That perfectly constitutional act of President Lincoln in issuing the greenbacks created a furor in the Rothschild-controlled banking circles throughout the world. It was denounced and condemned by an editorial in the London Times as follows. Quote, if this mischievous financial policy, which has its origin in the North American Republic, shall become indurated down to a fixture, then that government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off all its debts and be without debt. It will have all the money necessary to carry on its commerce. It will become prosperous without precedence in the history of the world. The brains and the wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe, unquote. Immediately after Lincoln issued the greenbacks, the big bankers of New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, who, as was stated before, were already playing footsies with the House of Rothschild, held a convention in Washington. Then, as today, they found many stooges willing to be bribed and seduced in both houses of Congress, and the infamous, quote, National Banking Act, unquote, of 1863 was enacted into law. Naturally, they had plenty of help from the money racketeers in England and Paris to help them gain control of the nation's money. From London came something called, quote, the Hazard Circular, unquote, a financial publication to be distributed among the small fry bankers in America. It read as follows, quote, "Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers. While the European plan led on by England is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the war must be used to control the value of money. To accomplish this, government bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now waiting for the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States to make that recommendation. It will not do to allow, quote, greenbacks, unquote, as they are called, to circulate as money for any length of time, as we cannot control that, the greenbacks. But we can control the bonds and through them the banking issues," unquote. Thus, the National Banking Act became law by an act of a cowardly and actually treasonous to the people they represented, Congress over President Lincoln's veto. Without going into the details, the provisions of that 1863 National Banking Act enabled the banker pirates of that era to not only get money for nothing with which to create a bank exactly as the Federal Reserve Act has been enabling them to do since 1913, but also the power to create conditions whereby great wealth could be achieved via rigged stock market manipulations, as also through foreclosing mortgages on real property placed in their hands by those who borrowed money or credit from those early manipulators. Now let me show you what that National Banking Act did to our nation in those years. In 1866, there was $1,906,687,000 in currency circulating in our country, or approximately $50 per capita. In 1867, the job of reducing the nation's money was launched by the banker robber barons, resulting in the destruction of more than $86 million. The disappearance of that money from circulation caused almost 2,400 business failures. In the next year, $473 million more dollars disappeared from circulation, causing more than 2,600 additional business failures. That same kind of currency disappearance continued throughout the next dozen years and resulted in a total of more than 55,000 business failures, with a total loss of about $2.5 billion of dollars of real money. The majority of the losses sustained came as a result of mortgage foreclosures. That was the way the real wealth of the American people had slowly but surely been passing into the hands of the bankers. The Rothschilds had failed in their scheme to divide the nation between them by force of arms, but the new tactics they were employing was successfully accomplishing their objective. At this point, it is pertinent to remind that they, the Rothschilds, had gained full control of the Bank of England in 1816. Also, that the banking system in the United States had become, to all intents and purposes, just a branch of the English banking system, and therefore was largely under Rothschild control. And it is a tragic fact, via the Federal Reserve Act, the situation today is not much different. Now, the real objective of that Federal Reserve Act has always remained a very deep, dark secret. But of course, the people finally had to be told about the existence of the new law, but of course, they were never told the truth. Now, in view of all the foregoing revelations, and they are true revelations, one might well ask, Why did the people accept that new law, the Federal Reserve Act, with such seemingly bovine complacency? The answer is, they were not only kept in ignorance of the real objective of that act, they were lulled into a feeling of security. They were promised that the objective of that act was to prevent forever all panics, bank failures, and all depressions in the future. They were promised that the moment a bank failure was imminent, the Federal Reserve System would rush to the rescue and prevent the failure. They were promised that the first sign of a panic, the Federal Reserve System would rush to the rescue and prevent it. All those promises were deliberate lies, of course, because as has been previously asked, where was the Federal Reserve Act and the system in 1929 when the bankers rigged the stock market crash in 1929? Where were they when all the banks closed their doors following that crash? There was still another reason why the people accepted the Federal Reserve Act without suspicion. While there has never been an official revealment that the Federal Reserve System and its 12 Federal Reserve banks are privately owned, the people were led to believe that both were government institutions, that the whole thing was actually a branch of our Treasury Department. That is a brazen falsehood. Now, there is one other vital point for every American to note. Our U.S. Treasury does not print any of our currency. All of it is printed by the Federal Reserve System. If you have the slightest doubt of that statement, examine your dollar, $5, $20, and $100 bills. You will find that every dollar in your possession bears the statement, Federal Reserve Note. And do you know how much it costs the Federal Reserve to print those billions? Hundreds of billions of dollars? Well, just the cost of the ink and paper provided by the U.S. printing office of our Treasury Department, an infinitesimal amount. And that's how much the dollars in your pocket and in your savings account are really worth. Well, at this point, I must tell you that I could go on and on about the various phases of the Edomite Jew Rothschild international banker conspiracy to create a one-world Jewish kingdom where all Jews will be kings and everyone else slaves, but I must stop this message somewhere.